Hey everyone, Ray Robinson here, host of the Unsensitive Podcast. You're probably wondering, what does unsensitive mean? Well, it's a completely made-up word to define a topic that is insensitive to talk about at family gatherings and parties, but you talk about them anyway. New episodes drop every other Tuesday evening at 7 p.m. Eastern, part of the Fearscape Media Network.
There is no question that something is here, lurking somewhere in the darkened corners. But how will we ever find out what it is? We need to look, always, and never stop. No matter what stands in our way, no matter what others may think. Explore the darkness. Shine light into it. Join the red strings and the silver threads. Everything is connected, somehow. I am Mark L. Watson. This is Peer Beyond the Veil.
I started to get into this, I suppose, in the very early days when I was about 10 years old. And I had a sighting then when I was coming out of a youth club. I used to go to a Roman Catholic school and we used to have a youth club on a Friday night. And that's probably about 9 o'clock at night, quarter to nine, something like that. And I was with a school friend, school classmate, and we both saw this sort of star-like object, well, two of them actually, sort of doing acrobatics around one another and going off into the distance. But, you know, it was something I knew at the time. It wasn't a star. It wasn't anything like that. It was something unusual, which Bowell writes shouldn't have been there, really, you know, in the normal scheme of things. And then the next sighting I had was around about 1990 in the summertime. And I saw this sort of like a giant illuminated dragonfly type object. It's really hard to describe. I do describe it in the book that I've written, Acknowledged. It just kind of zipped across the sky. Never seen anything like it before. Never even read about anything like it being described by anybody else. Don't really know what it was. Another light in the sky lasted about 3 seconds, I think. Very quick, whatever it was. Next one would have been 2005, I think, and I was here where I live now in Derbyshire, and I was walking along the canal path just what we have just next to where we live, disused canal, and I saw what I thought was a child's balloon, and I was watching it, just slowly drifting across. It was a beautiful summer's day. It was July, I think it was, I think it was July the 15th, if I remember the date properly. And then it seemed to like three or four of these objects seemed to materialize near it, or seemed to like almost come into materialization, but not quite. It was kind of weird. But I thought, well, I've got to go closer look at this. And I was literally about 50 yards from my house. So I ran back to the house to try and get a pair of binoculars because I was just out stretching my legs, you know, on a sunny afternoon. And I went up to my daughter's bedroom because looking out of that bedroom window is the direction of the object. Gone, completely gone. And even if it was a child's balloon, you know, I still would have been able to see it because it was slowly drifting across. So and that was, you could say, daylight sighting, broad daylight, like 2 o'clock in the afternoon or something. It was something like that. And it just gone. So again, what was that? I don't know. And the final sighting that I had was another nighttime sighting. It was about 10 o'clock, half 10 at night. I'd been to see a friend who were actually on holiday in Pembrokeshire, and I'd been to see a friend who lived near Cardigan, and sat in his front room chatting away, and I'd sort of lean my head out, I was just sort of looking at an angle out of his front window, and I saw an orange orb and a white orb sort of a, probably not quite as big as the full moon, about maybe two thirds the size of a full moon, coming to sort of towards and over the house. And the view is quite restricted, but we both leaned out. He saw it, I saw it. And so we ran upstairs, but by the time we got up there, these orbs had disappeared.
As we follow on from last week's episode about the terrifying encounter that Terry Lovelace had at Devil's Den, our focus is drawn to the aftermath. Whilst the disturbing details of the tale are those from the deserted clearing in the middle of the Arkansas forest and what happened a few hundred feet above it, it's as important that the focus shift to who may have been in on it all. The Air Force and the other government agencies who interrogated Terry Lovelace and the poor Toby when they returned to the base seemingly knew, at least some of them, way more than they were letting on. The truth, the reality, the secret that we civilians occasionally stumble onto is kept hidden away at all costs. When information leaks, it's nearly always deliberate. They tell us that there is disclosure, that they're willing to share information, but either it's intentional misinformation or their hands are otherwise forced. What they know, whoever they are, is a secret that they will, and indeed have, killed to protect. Human collateral damage is immaterial. We're all dispensable when it comes to the master plan. Former Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid admitted himself that the information we have only scratches the surface of the research and materials that the US government hold. And while some nations are more open about their research programs and funding, there is still a huge veil of secrecy draped across government involvement. My guest tonight is trying to lift the lid, rip down the curtain, kick the door off its hinges, and expose the cover-up. His books detail not only the great UFO cover-up, but also that of 9/11 and of global warming, amongst others. Though far from being a conspiracy theorist as such, Andrew Johnson joins us tonight to talk through his work exposing the lies that we're habitually told. Whilst the government's aim to keep we, the people, in fear, drip-feeding their own agendas into our lives and shaping us how they wish, Andrew implores us to try and peer beyond the veil.
Then it was really getting heavily into it was from 2003 when the broadband internet started becoming more prevalent. And, you know, and then I found Stephen Greer's Disclosure Project following, I watched a BBC documentary about the Rendlesham incident and went searching for that, found the Disclosure Project, sort of thought, wow, you know, that was these 21 witnesses, military people, John Callahan, head of the FAA. Yes, so Dr. Stephen Greer, this emergency room doctor, or allegedly anyway, and he'd started to, in fact, I understand he got a lot of his research off another researcher called Bill Hamilton, who'd identified quite a lot of whistleblowers. And so he, Greer, got together this group of witnesses, totaling at the time in by 2001, 400, I think he had around then, military people, people who worked for civilian airlines, government officials, government officers, army officials, and he recorded their testimony on video. You know, spent 1 to 5 hours with each of these witnesses and recorded the video, and then he made this 2-hour DVD. He did this press conference. That was, I think, in 16th of May, was it? It was May 2001, anyway. He live streamed it, one of probably the early times where events were live streamed on the internet. You know, their servers crashed and stuff. And they were all saying, you know, they had encountered, they'd watched these objects, they'd seen them landing, they'd seen aliens get out, you know, all these stories. And many of them very, very credible witnesses, and they would swear an oath to Congress, you know, if called for an inquiry. Some of them, I later learned, weren't quite as reliable as you might think. Some of these witnesses, for example, Clifford Stone, apparently a lovely guy, but I don't think he was being totally honest in his testimony. Larry Warren, you know, we could make a whole program about Larry Warren, for example. he initially seemed like a genuine witness, but I think there are certain skeletons in his cupboard, shall we say, and some of them seem to have come out in the last two or three years. But I think the overall thing was, with all these witnesses being put together with some particularly compelling witnesses, to me at least, as I say, John Callahan, who was the head of the FAA, Graham Bethune, who was an airline pilot who was flying from Keflavik, Iceland, across back to the US in the 1950s. I think he was, you know, obviously in the Air Force, US Air Force. He encountered a very brilliant object with a corona discharge, described it very clearly, you know, went up and down in front of his plane, and the passengers saw it, and people ducked and, you know, banged their heads and stuff because they were afraid that this thing was going to crash into them. There's no reason he would make such a story up, you know, totally authentic guy. Totally, and you just tell, you know, by the way he relates the story, he doesn't care what you think of him. He tells the story as it happened.
Sure.
Lovely guy, you know. I actually ended up meeting a few of the one or two of the witnesses over a period of time. One of Greer's disclosure witnesses, for example, similar type of scenario to what you described. You know, totally genuine guy, Robert Jacobs, Bob Jacobs, who you probably heard. It's a very well known story now. That he was in the optical instruments division of the Air Force at Vandenberg Air Force Base. Basically, they filmed this missile test. I'll give a very quick summary of it. You can watch the video. Anyone can go and watch the video. Filmed this missile test with special instrumentation, a very powerful telescope, and it with a film camera attached to it. So this is like late 60s, I think 67, I think it was. And it was quite a difficult project technically, because they were trying to track this missile in flight from 100 miles away, and he describes all of how they did it. And then they got back to the Air Force base with this film of this missile, and the next day, you know, they find he's captured a flying saucer on it, zapping the warhead on this missile, which they couldn't see with the naked eye because it was like 100 miles away or something. They could just see this sort of smoke trail. And I met him, you know. Totally genuine guy. And his story was corroborated by his boss, you know, Sonny Mansman, he was called, Major Mansman, who became his friends. There are so many accounts like that now. And I think particularly with the advent of the internet, you know, being able to do things like the Disclosure Project. And then, for example, the other thing which, you know, drew me into that Disclosure Project was the documentation, where there was sufficient documents that had been, been retrieved or kept by some of the witnesses or, you know, obtained under Freedom of Information. And then you could see those as well. You could see copies of those. That whole Japan Airlines case, you know, John Callan had the documents for there. And he had a tape of the radar that they watched of this object flying about, you know, on the radar, which they made back in the 80s when there was an inquiry. I was discussing with somebody a few days ago the footage that was captured by Martin Stubbs from the space shuttle. Martin Stubbs was this guy who had his own satellite receiver dish at a TV station. I think it was in New Zealand, but I may be getting that mixed up. It might have been Australia. Might have even been the US, but I have a feeling it was New Zealand. I'd have to go and check the story again. He recorded about 400 hours of video from the space shuttle, and lo and behold, there's a fair amount of this footage has objects on it doing unusual things. And there's a couple of particular things where you have this glowing disc coming, you know, in the clouds that you can see from the space shuttle. It lights up on this camera, you know, and I think it's an infrared camera they've got on at the time. And you can see it going into these thunderstorms and doing things. It's incredible. And this is all from the space shuttle. It's essentially NASA footage. There's stuff like that, you know, and you find all this evidence now that, for me, it became much more important back, and that's why I got involved with the Disclosure Project. And I downloaded the press conference, and I was like, I actually went and bought a flipping LCD projector, and I got that so I could stick this thing on a laptop and then take it around and show it at, meetings. But when I tried to get people interested in organised meetings, I found that nobody would turn up. You know, I'd book a room, pay 20 quid for a room or something, or 30 quid, put some flyers up locally, and nobody would turn up. I had one person turn up at one meeting, one or two at another. I found it very difficult to actually get something going. So I then hit upon the idea of approaching groups that already met, you know, that have speakers. So I went and I approached them and says, do you want a speaker? You know, give me fiver for the petrol or something, and I'll do you a talk sort of thing, you know. And I told them what it was about. And then I would take my projector along, set my screen up, set my laptop up, ba-bum, you know, and do an hour's presentation on it. And that worked quite well because at least I had an audience. You know, I was getting sort of 10, 15, 20, 30, 40 people, whatever size the meeting was.
Do you feel attitude to it has changed, that there's becoming a wider acceptance, that if you were to, for example, be holding those meetings or putting out those flyers now, you may get in a bigger audience than back then? That the public interest is growing?
Maybe in some ways. But I honestly don't think it's changed all that much in terms of most people still think of it as a curiosity. And what I've come to realize is it's very much more than a curiosity. It's actually, some of it relates to, it explains why the world is like it is. If you know about the alien stuff and things to do with that, I find now that I can make more sense of why the world is like it is because I know about some of that stuff. So that's the way I look at it now. So it's still very important to me. But what I've come to kind of realize is that to kind of convey that whole understanding to people, it's just about impossible, because it's taken me probably over 10 years of very intensive research and thinking to come to those conclusions. When I first discovered the Disclosure Project, I was particularly taken with the Gordon Cooper clip, for example. And I thought he was being totally genuine. And I still think that. I still think what Cooper said and what he described, particularly the story of the landing at Edwards Air Force Base, I think it was, in 55. I couldn't believe it when I'd heard that. But I think he only started telling that story in 1997. Because I heard him tell that story in James Fox's Out of the Blue. That was where I heard it first. But later, with more viewing and more research, I discovered that it was actually that story he told was actually, I think it came out. You remember the Strange But True series from the 1990s with Michael Aspel? I think they did some type of special in about 1997, and that special featured Gordon Cooper. And he spoke about that landing incident then. I don't think they had the simulation like James Fox did. But that Out of the Blue film, I still think, is one of the best documentaries. And that kind of some of that testimony that James Fox had, they shared that with Greer. So there was like a link with some of the Disclosure Project stuff. And I think they did work together a little bit on that. And that was some of that was really good. But you know, you mentioned these people like Chris Mellon and so forth, and that the thing that they got involved with more recently is in To the Stars Academy. And you see, I began to realize, and I realized this with Greer, and I started to realize this in round about 2008, that Stephen Greer and what he was doing wasn't, there was a bit more to it. And he was basically, the way I see things now, he was doing what we call limited hangouts. So I think Greer knew quite a bit more about what was going on in the background. And he was taking a certain stance. So I learned a bit later on, for example, and this particularly came out with Greer's work on the free energy. And that was a big thing for me when I looked at that, because the big difference for me about the Disclosure Project was that they were talking about energy as well. Greer was talking about free energy technology, not just the UFO stuff. And he was making the case that if you look at these crafts and you accept that they come here and they do things, they land, you know, they interact with people, they're either shot down or brought down or they crash. You know, that's one of those questions, isn't it? If you talk about UFO crashes with anyone, and they're not really that, they haven't studied that much. They say, well, that's just stupid. You know, these advanced space people, they come all the way across the galaxy and then they crash here. That's nonsense. So therefore it doesn't happen. They'd be too advanced for that to happen. They wouldn't crash. That's useless. And of course, that makes a lot of implicit assumptions. A, that they don't have accidents. You know, you don't know anything about their technology, so you don't know whether it, how reliable it would be. You just assume that they would be so advanced that wouldn't happen. And the other thing that Greer points out, and I agree with him on this, and others have said the same, is that these things were brought down, they were shot down. And it appears that they were discovered, in the end of the Second World War, that radar, high-powered radar, could interfere with the guidance systems, and there's certain of the witnesses that said that, and I think that's correct. I think that's true. So how these things crash doesn't necessarily mean by accident. You know, they could get struck by lightning, as I think was one of the stories about the Roswell crash. That's what happened to that craft. Or they get brought down by military technology. And I think there's been actually a fair bit of that has been done, that they have brought these things down. And I agree with Greer on that. But I was digressing slightly. So he's talking about, if you get into that and you think, well, okay, let's accept these craft come here, they've crashed, they've landed, they've taken off again, they've flown away again, the people have been in them. How do they work? How do they work? That's really, when you really start to research it, and you go past this, oh, I saw this funny thing in the sky, or, you know, my next door neighbor says that she was taken in a craft. When you get past that level of things, you start to go a bit deeper. If you're curious like I am, you've got to start asking yourself, how do these things work? How are they propelled? Are they truly 100% physical objects, or do they dematerialize? Do they come from other dimensions? You start to get into some of those other questions. Now, of course, what Greer did was he accepted that these operate on a different technology. It's not nuclear power as we know it. It's not fossil fuel. You know, it's not. It's something else. It's an energy. You know, it's an energy technology of some kind, or a technology that could be used to manifest free energy out of the vacuum, zero point energy. You know, electrogravitics, magnetogravitics. You start to get into those things. And you start to think, how do these things work? And that's when Greer, for example, set up this SEAS power project. And he called it Space Energy Access Systems. And he did that, he said it, I think at the time, if I remember his words correctly, that it was a SEASETI project. And I think somewhere, and again, I may be misquoting him, but he said he was acting, you know, because he'd had contacts of some kind, and these beings said, oh, you know, you've got to do this, Stephen, you've got to get involved with this, and you've got to start this energy initiative. And I think, again, he's implied that. I could be wrong, but it doesn't really matter if I am wrong on this part. He ended up doing it anyway. He set up this SEAS power, however he said he did it, or whoever said he influenced him to do it, he did do it. SEAS power website, go on there, you can find it in the Internet Archive. And he said, let's get these inventors who've invented this technology, you know, they've got this free energy battery, they've got this free energy generator that they've built in their shed, their garage, their workshop. We want to get that out to the public so that we can solve the energy crisis. And I thought, 2003, when I heard this, I thought, that's fantastic. If he can do that, that's brilliant. Great idea. We all want free energy, you know, free transport, et cetera, et cetera. And, but then in 2007, he set up Aero 2012. And I looked at this Aero 2012 website and it said, let's get inventors and investors together and develop this free energy technology. And I looked at this website and I looked at the SEAS Power website, and they're exactly the same. He's just changed this color scheme. And all the articles were the same. He had the same forms to sign up, get an inventor. You know, if you're an inventor, sign up here, send me details, we'll come and see you, da-di-da-di-da. And I thought, that's a bit fishy. And then he did it again. He did it in 2010, I think it was. I've written all this up in several articles. And he formed the Orion Project. And he said he wanted to get $3 million to build a research facility. But nowhere in any of this documentation did he say how he'd got on with these free energy projects, you know, which ones had worked, which ones hadn't worked. Why did the SEAS power thing not Was it not successful? Why did it have to change to Aero 2012? Why did Aero 2012 then become, you know, Orion Technologies? Why did then that become Sirius Disclosure Technologies 2 years later? Now, and I was talking to somebody, for example, over that period of time, who said that they were attached. And attached means they work for the intelligence services. And I got to know this guy. And he told me that Greer was worth $14 million. And over time, I think that's probably correct. Where has that money gone, Mr. Dr. Greer? Where has it gone? It has not brought anything out. Nothing came out. There's no free energy devices, no visible development. The last thing he talked about was acquiring the Stanley Meyer materials. Now, Stanley Meyer, for listeners that don't know, developed this water-powered car in the 1980s and 1990s, and he ended up dead. He got poisoned. And people can look up that story. And Greer then claimed to have acquired some of the plans or the materials for this water-powered car. And I think, based on what I saw of that, I think that Meyer's thing worked. I think he did what he said. He did what he claimed. And I think what he said was true. And I think it was a very important device. But again, it's gone, you know, it's gone into the hole somewhere. It's gone now. It was demonstrated on a Channel 4 documentary back in the 1990s. I've got copies of that documentary. Very, very interesting documentary narrated by William Woolard. It's called It Runs on Water. And in fact, you know, it gets even worse because in an interview that Greer did on a podcast, this was probably about 5 years ago now, and I've got all of this in my book. I've written this book called Acknowledged, The Perspective on UFOs, Aliens, and Crop Circles. And in this interview that Greer did, he says that he was doing all this disclosure project stuff, you know, and he was getting a lot of hassle from the agencies because, you know, he was revealing all this stuff. And then he said that they were being threatened. And he said he had a meeting with somebody from the CIA and says, well, if you're being threatened, you want protection. And he says, well, yeah. So he actually said that he was offered protection by the CIA. So I think that is really another way of saying that he works for the CIA. I was interested in the whole thing. I wasn't just a fan of Greer. I wasn't just a fan of the Disclosure Project. I wanted to find out what the aliens were. You know, who are these aliens? And as Lord Hill Nelson says, Lord Hill Norton said a few years back, he says it in James Fox's documentary, actually. He says, you know, if it is true that we are being visited and have been visited by many years by people from other planets, it behooves us to find out who these people are, why they're here, and what they want. And I thought, yeah, you know, that's absolutely right. And this is what Wilbert Smith said as well, the Canadian radio engineer. So I'm just as interested in those questions. And then around the same time I came across the Disclosure Project, I came across the Star Child skull. And it was being looked after by this chap called Lloyd Pye. Now, Lloyd Pye had done a lot of research into Bigfoot and Sasquatch and all of those sorts of areas. And he had this really weird skull. And it was a 900 years old. And this had been carbon dated twice. It was 900 years old. It was found in a cave in Mexico in 1930, or at least that's the story he was told. It was found with a human skull. And they were both carbon dated to 900 years old. And this particular skull had 25 physical differences to a human skull that it was found with. Its eye sockets were only half an inch deep. Human eye sockets are 2 inches deep. They did some x-rays on it. They found it had no sinuses at all. which Lloyd said, well, that proves it's not a human skull, because you know, all humans have sinuses, but actually learned a bit later that that's not true. Some humans are born without sinuses. It's pretty rare, but it does happen. The capacity of the skull, the cranial capacity, I think was 1400 cc's. And even if you look at it, it looks quite a bit smaller than a human skull. The human skull has 1200 cc capacity. And it looks perfectly symmetric. It doesn't look deformed. It has no inion. This is a bone at the back of your skull, but an inion bone. It doesn't have one of those. You can see if you look carefully where the muscles attached, all the muscles attach in different places. The chewing muscles are much smaller. They had a part of the jawbone as well, the maxilla, I should say, and they extracted some teeth. And the teeth were somewhat different as well. There were certain anomalies with the teeth. If you look at that piece of bone and look at the inside of the skull, it appears that it had a very small tongue or no tongue at all. The way that the brain would have been in the skull, the angle of the back of the skull, if the brain was made of the same stuff as our brain, because of the way the skull was angled on the neck, the brain would have fallen out of the skull. The viscosity of the brain, the grey matter, the way it is in the skull, it would have fallen out. So his brain was different. The visual cortex was different. All kinds of stuff that he investigated. They eventually did DNA tests on it. The first test they did was botched. They used ordinary DNA testing at a Bold lab in British Columbia in 1999. And that's the results they report on Wikipedia. You go and look up the Star Child skull on Wikipedia, it will say it's a deformed human skull. It was DNA tested in 1999 and found to be human. That is true, but it was DNA tested again in 2003 with better techniques, using techniques for ancient DNA, because that's what was needed. And that came out that mitochondrial DNA looked to be human, but the nuclear DNA wasn't recovered, which was very unusual, because the human skull, which was in the same place as the Star Child, that had human DNA recovered from 900 years ago, and it was human, and it fitted where it was found in Mexico, the DNA haplotype and so forth. But what happened with the DNA was it was retested in 2003, as I say. At that point, they thought that this was an alien hybrid, because the reason for that was that they recovered the mitochondrial DNA, because there's two main types of DNA that you can get from humans. The mitochondrial DNA, which is passed down the maternal line, in other words, from the mother, and the nuclear DNA, which comes from the mother's and father's DNA, from their genes. And they couldn't recover the Star Child's nuclear DNA at all in 2003. So they didn't, but they assumed that because they could recover the mitochondrial DNA, it had a human mother and an alien father. The human bone is about, is nine millimeters thick, I think it is. The Star Child's 3 millimeters thick. The bone chemistry, they took a piece of bone, they dissolved it, they did a mass spectrometry of the bone. The bone chemistry is all different. It has fibers in the bone. It's totally different. This is not a human skull. It's totally different. There's nothing about this skull which says that it's human, other than it's, you know, it's got two eye sockets and the morphology is similar. But everything else says that this is not a human skull. And that was, again, emphasized even further from 2010, because in 2010, Lloyd was approached by a geneticist who worked for, I think he worked for some company that was, well, they were doing DNA research of some kind. And this guy was in a lab where he had access to DNA sequencing equipment, and he got permission from his company to use this equipment to test the Star Child's DNA from a tooth that they still had. And he did it on the quiet in the back room. The company, I don't know who the company was, because they said, look, you can do it, but we're having nothing to do with it. We give permission to use the equipment, but you don't tell anybody, you know, about what company you work for and where this has come from. You can send in the results, but other than that, you can forget it. And all I know is that this guy, he was former Soviet Union. He'd gone to the US, I think, from the Soviet Union. That's basically all I know. But he did tests over a period of time using what's called a shotgun recovery. And that went on for a period of about 2 years, two and a bit years, I think, doing bits on the side, bits on the quiet. Lloyd wanted to recover the whole genome, which is 3 billion base pairs. But he said that to do that, it would cost $250,000 to get that all done and document it all properly. They said it was going to cost $250,000. This guy basically did it for nothing or next to nothing on the quiet, but he only recovered something like 40,000 base pairs. So I think it was less than 1% of the whole genome that they recovered. And Lloyd talked about this publicly for many years. And it basically came out that what from the DNA that they'd recovered, and they compared it to obviously known samples, some of the sequences of DNA didn't match any other species on Earth, which, you know, like, for example, us, I think our DNA is like 60% the same as a millipede, you know, or something. I forget the exact figures. People can go and look these up. We're 98% the same as chimpanzees, and think how physically different we are from chimpanzees. Okay, we've got two arms, two legs, whatever, two eyes. When they did the star child DNA, but on percentage terms, 56% the same was the estimate they made before this research ended. 56% the same. It's like nowhere near human. Not. And the geneticist said at the end of his time he was doing the research, this is from a non-intersecting evolutionary line to humans, sure, meaning it's not from around here. Lloyd separately, you know, he sort of goes into why he doesn't think the standard theory of evolution is correct. And indeed, you know, you talk about things like punctuated equilibrium, and that's in the textbooks about evolution, you know, and that's an admission that no species has ever changed into another species. You know, and as Lloyd pointed out in many of his talks, there is such a thing as microevolution, where, you know, that happened in the Galapagos Islands, where the different species of birds have mini adaptions to the environment. But you never get a species of, you know, bird turning into another species of bird. It just doesn't happen. You know, that's a separate sort of conversation, really. But so the star child skull, as far as I'm concerned, it is physical evidence of an alien being.
It doesn't take a conspiracist or a revisionist to understand that what we're told by the powers that be is indeed tailored to suit largely their own agendas. The truth is hidden, and very often for the greater good. There are many aspects of what goes on behind the closed doors of our government buildings that would fuel fires of fear and panic should they be publicly released, the press draining everything they can from them and hanging the lot out to dry. It's the responsibility of the government to keep some of those secrets. We as civilians should not be entitled to know every last thing if it's not for our own benefit. But what the government knows about should not be a blanket of lies to lay over all the business it conducts. Why should it be down to tenacious civilians to slowly chip away at the thick veneer of deception to try to understand certain human truths? Our place on this world, in this universe, is ours. There should be no men and women in control of the great underlying truth, of which we are apparently not worthy. And so the habit of deception becomes a hard one to break. The default attitude becomes one of need to know, and we apparently very rarely need to know much. Keep us quiet, keep us in line, keep things under the great hand. War is peace, freedom is slavery, ignorance is strength, as Orwell wrote. But such an attitude leads down a rabbit hole. The lies become more frequent. They shift from being about purely public safety to being about business and commercial interests, home and abroad. Wars declared in inconsequential far-off lands in the name of money and oil.
We're going to talk about Science Applications International Corporation, right? Now, Science Applications International Corporation is a company, US defense contractor. Now, this was mentioned by one of Greer's disclosure witnesses, Denise McKenzie, I think is her name, and it's in Greer's disclosure book. And she talks about this company, mentioned it a couple of times, and she says that they're big benefactors of the black budget. So they're one of these contractors that appear to have been given either bits of technology or lots of information to study or reverse engineer or do something with, right? And this company, if you look at them, it's a very unusual company, and it's an employee-owned company. And there's a documentary that's been made by a friend of mine called Chris Hampton, and he talks about SAIC quite a bit in that documentary. So when you find out, for example, that Science Applications International Corporation did at least two things. One thing that they did was they helped set up a communications grid around the World Trade Center after it had been destroyed. And they also were in charge of ground zero security at the World Trade Center site from the 12th of September 2001. Not only that, but they coordinated the production of the technical reports about the destruction of the World Trade Center, which were released in August 2005. And NIST, which is the National Institute for Standards and Technology, they were given $16 million by Congress to produce these 10,000 pages of reports, which you can download if you want to. You may not be aware, and this is where it tied together with the other research that I've probably spent even more time on the UFO stuff, was 9/11. That Science Applications International Corporation, they were actually defendants in a court case that was launched by my friend, Dr. Judy Wood. Now, Dr. Judy Wood, she's written a book called Where Did the Towers Go? And that's all about how the World Trade Center was destroyed. And she started looking at that on the 11th of September 2001, when she watched it being destroyed. And she, from day one, did not accept the official account of what happened. I did. I was taken in by that story, for at least 18 months, well, about 18 months. I was just traumatized by it, as most of us were. She didn't. And then she ended up doing a lot of research. Dr. Judy Wood wrote this book, and in that book, she actually shows you the results of experiments by a chap called John Hutchison, who's a Canadian experimental physicist. Now, of course, he was doing experiment, and he comes up in the UFO community from time to time, or in various documentaries, that, like Nick Cook, who did the Hunt for Zero Point in 1999. You may have seen that, maybe. John Hutchison comes up in his film about that, where, you know, Nick Cook's going across, he's looking at all the black programs, are black programs the UFOs, are all these UFO sightings just sightings of secret aircraft, that sort of chestnut. And Nick Cook explores that. I've communicated with Nick Cook a few times. And in that program he made in 99 is John Hutchison, who's this Canadian experimental researcher who was making things fly up in the air, and he was bending metals and making things disappear. And he was doing this in the 1980s, And funnily enough, if you look at what happened at the World Trade Center, you find that things were levitated and some things disappeared, like 210-story buildings basically disappeared. And they did disappear because they didn't make a seismic signature, and you can see them turning to dust before they hit the ground. And then you find out, for example, that John Hutchison, he was visited in 1983 by a chap called Colonel John Alexander, who's written a book about UFOs and talks about UFOs on Coast to Coast and goes to conferences and kind of doesn't debunk UFOs, but kind of doesn't quite, say that they're real either. It's kind of like in between kind of thing. It's kind of strange. But he worked with John Hutchison for 4 months. And at the time, he was acting as a consultant to Los Alamos National Laboratories, which is where they developed the A-bomb. And of course, this isn't just a theory, you see, because this evidence, before being put in the book, was taken to court. And I was involved in that back in between 2007 and 2009. And when Greer was asked a question about this, he basically dodged the question. I've got a recording of this, and the answer he gives is very interesting. And he kind of sort of acknowledges it, but then he comes out with a kind of diversionary, it's almost like he's a politician and he's answering the question that he wants to answer, not the one that is being asked. And he sort of says he knew about it, but then he just goes off into this sort of nondescript explanation about being in the ER doctor and how they let the planes come in or something. I forget exactly the way he says it, but he doesn't answer that question. He does not answer it. And you can tell he's extremely uncomfortable with it. And if that was me, and I was being shown that SAIC were involved in the destruction of the World Trade Center, which they were, I'd find that pretty important stuff to be talking about. But has he talked about it since? No. What he's talked about is Al-Qaeda and all of that stuff, which is what everyone else talks about. And he's talked about that from day one. And again, when, and that's when I became suspicious of Greer. You know, Greer has never talked about 9/11, not even to say he doesn't. You know, I'd be happy if Greer says, I don't believe the official story of 9/11. And I think knowing what he knew, knowing what he knows, he should have been suspicious of the official story on 9/11, you know, of 9/11 on day one. He you know, he didn't need to say any more than that. But no, he doesn't do that. He talks about global terrorism. He talks about this risk of terrorism, you know, and so does Steve Bassett, actually. You know, you go and read his Forbidden Knowledge book. You see what you think. You even read my book as well. See what you think of what I've written about him. You know, I'm not out to I don't want to do anyone down. You know, I'm not like that. I just want the truth. And finding the truth, it can be really hard work psychologically when you find out that these. But I thought Greer was great. I thought, and like Edgar Mitchell as well. When I found out about him, Edgar Mitchell, he's become the darling of the UFO movement because he said that the Roswell crash was real and the aliens were recovered. And this is the guy that allegedly walked on the moon. People are going, oh, that's fantastic. It helps the disclosure movement so much. You know, but then you find out that Edgar Mitchell is not who he appeared to be. He threatened to shoot Bart Sobrell. He threatened Bruce De Palma, who invented a free energy device in the 1980s. You know, he said that he walked on the moon, but he couldn't remember what it felt like. He said that in an interview in 1996. He admitted that he worked for the CIA in 1972. He admitted that on a 2013 documentary about Uri Geller. He said that he reported to George Bush, the CIA, because they were investigating the whole, you know, telekinesis, telepathy, Uri Geller phenomenon and all of that stuff, you know, which is true. They were. He was doing that. And you start to look into what Uri Geller was doing and what he was like, you know, and Andrei Puharich and all of that. And it's, you get into some very, very murky areas. Like, and the whole thing with John Alexander. You know, what's he doing working with John Hutchison for 4 months? What, and then flipping John Alexander's involved in all that psychic spy stuff, you know, this Operation Stargate with Joe McGonagall and Paul Smith and those other guys, Lynn Buchanan. He's wrapped up in all of that stuff. And again, this is what frustrates me, because from what Greer put out, I found out about Wilbert Smith, the Canadian radio engineer. He was a really significant figure. His name is kind of somewhat known, but it's mainly known in connection with this top secret memo, which he wrote in 1950, saying that you know, flying saucers are real and the security classification is 2 points higher than the A-bomb or the H-bomb. And that memo was published and so written in 1950 and was declassified in 1979. And the thing that is in that memo, which is really interesting, is that he talks about the Americans in 1950, knowing that the UFO issue had something to do with mental phenomena. He uses that term, mental phenomena, you know. So this, again, ties into all this, these telepathic experiences. And some people say that these craft, the only way they can operate them is through thought control and so forth. I think what we're getting an indication of is, yeah, they do know this stuff. They do know stuff. And there is a lot more to it than is generally spoken of, you know, in a lot of these books. It goes across all things. In other words, it goes across consciousness. It goes across energy topics, cover-ups, military, anti-gravity. It's another big area, which I've written this book about, which covers a lot of that stuff. It covers so many areas. And then again, that's what frustrates me when other people don't get drill down into those areas, you know, because you get a much, I think you get a, start to get a much better handle that basically, yes, it's all to do with energy and consciousness. That's the key thing.
Who's declassifying all this stuff then? And why? Why is there this kind of seemingly deliberate drip feed of teasing information where documents are declassified 30 years after they were written? You know, and that's maybe you're looking at the NSA or the GCHQ for that level of stuff. But why? Who's controlling that release of information? And why are they releasing?
I think it's like a safety. I think it's like a safety valve. I think it's another way of keeping human consciousness at a certain level. It's what I call limited hangouts. So, you know, the regular public doesn't really care about any of this stuff. You know, the people who are just watching, sort of trapped in TV soap land or whatever analogy you care to draw, they don't really care. Okay, they might watch an occasional sort of X-Files episode, or they might see an occasional sort of ITV documentary, which says, you know, all the ITV or BBC documentaries are pretty much all the same. They say, oh, there's this curious thing happened to this guy. He saw this flying saucer landing in the field. It left some marks, you know. We investigated them and, you know, there was an unusual substance found there. And then at the end, they'll get a psychologist coming on saying, well, you know, he probably didn't see what he thought he saw, and those lab tests were probably just messed up, and, you know, and there might be aliens, but there might not be, and they probably didn't land in that field anyway. And then, you know, you're back to the start again. You know, there's no, it doesn't connect to anything else. And that's really, so that's like a limited hangout. That's the way that most people get stuck. But it's like, they've got to, if they want to kind of keep people appeased, there are going to be more curious people than that, a bit more forceful. So they'll give them a bit more information. So if you ask for a bit more, you'll get a bit more, you know. So if so, you say, well, yeah, we know they covered up this stuff in the 50s. Oh, yeah, okay, so here are these documents from the 50s. But these people are all dead now, like Wilbert Smith died in 1962, you know, and you can't really ask him anymore now. So we can release those documents. You know, because we can now control the damage without, you know, without killing too many people, you know, because they don't want to just go around killing people, because then it just becomes obvious, doesn't it, if they go have to kill a lot of people. But so I think it's like a managed disclosure to kind of just contain it within whatever sphere of curiosity that it's kind of manifesting in. And I think that some of the reasons are that there are still ongoing military projects which would be affected if that information was released. There are current things going on, or, you know, current commercial interests that would be heavily compromised by releasing certain information. People want to contact me about anything, and I'm happy to answer any questions or receive any flack for any comments I may have made tonight. I will stand by them all. It's checktheevidence.com. You can go onto that website. There's a contact button. You'll find my email splattered around there fairly liberally. It's my own site. I run it myself. I do post things by other people from time to time, but it's mainly my own postings and stuff. I have a link on there. It says free PDF books. There's 7 books. The book that I've mentioned tonight is called Acknowledged, A Perspective on the Matters of UFOs and Alien Crop Circles. That's got all the stuff about Grierin and all of that stuff and my sightings and whatnot and lots of other stuff. It's a free PDF download. You can get it for free. You can buy it on Amazon as a hard copy or an ebook. And there are 2 other books that kind of like form a trilogy with that one. One is called Finding the Secret Space Program, Removing Truth's Protective Layers, and that latter comment comes from Neil Armstrong. And the other one is called Secrets in the Solar System, Gatekeepers on Earth, which is all about solar system anomalies. And you can kind of think of those books as a kind of trilogy, really. And again, they're all free PDFs, or you can get them all on Amazon and a couple of other places, or you can order them from me via the website shop thing if you want to.
Well, Andrew, thank you so much for taking the time out of your evening. It's been an absolute pleasure speaking with you. Really, really enjoyed it. So, yeah, thank you for coming on.
Thank you very much, Mark, for having me.
Peer Beyond the Veil has been written and presented by myself, Mark Watson, as part of the Fearscape Media Network. Music and soundtracks are credited and licensed to Purple Planet and to Kevin MacLeod, licensed under Creative Commons. All rights are reserved by our parent company, MLW Publishing. You can follow us at facebook.com/peerbeyondtheveil or on Twitter at peerbeyondtheveil or at peerbeyond2020. Please click the like and subscribe buttons when you see them, most importantly, wherever you listen to your podcasts. It helps us to attract the attention we need to keep the show going, to get the guests that you all want to hear from, and to help more and more people